When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor, brought to you by Realtor Kim Purcell of Sutton Group Masters Realty. Connect with Kim today to find a new home tomorrow via kimpurcell.ca. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer Jesse Bell. Our top story today is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter Christina Laurie, covering the launch of Kingston's new food strategy.
The Food Policy Council for KFLNA is continuing its work towards a comprehensive regional food strategy, launching a series of five targeted focus groups over the coming weeks. In collaboration with Queen's University and other community partners, the Council is embarking on consultations designed to better understand what communities across Kingston, Frontenac, Lennox, and Addington need in order to build a sustainable and equitable local food system. These consultations will take a deeper dive into five key areas: rural food production, urban food production, food security, food retail and distribution, and food education and literacy. The first consultation, focused on rural food production, including farmers and market gardeners, took place on Monday. Members of the Food Policy Council co-chair Ellen Mortfield and Queen's University School of Environmental Studies assistant professor Kristen Lowitt sat down to discuss the launch of the consultation process and what it aims to achieve. Mortfield explained what's led the council to this stage in its work.
It's been quite a few years building to this point. Last year, working with Kristen and Queen's University, the Food Policy Council did secure a bit of funding to launch us on this process of starting a food strategy for Kingston, Frontenac, Lennox, and Addington. So we've been slowly building. We had some more casual potluck events over the summer just to get the conversation started. And now we're conducting these kind of targeted focus groups with specific sectors within the food system. So last night was our first one with the rural food production folks. We had a good turnout. I think there's about 20, wasn't there, Kristen?
Yeah, I think probably about 14, 15 producers.
Yeah. And really interesting conversations, lots of ideas. We started to work towards prioritizing some of those ideas, some action items that we'll be able to pursue. And all of these sort of ideas and goals and objectives and action plans will be set out in the finished food strategy. But at this stage, we're just trying to make note of these ideas, get people connected so we can start pursuing some of these action items, and really make some significant improvements over the next few years in people's access to local food in this area. That's the big goal.
Following several informal meetings over the summer and now one completed consultation, Lowitt says the council is already beginning to identify key themes emerging from the discussions. Among them, the importance of connection across different sectors of the food system and the notion of building food sovereignty in the region.
We did begin, maybe I'll step back for a second, right, in terms of slightly bigger context. So the Food Policy Council has been around since just over 10 years, since around 2013. And I think its mandate when it started was to contribute to the community food system in this region. And I think over the summer and the informal potluck series you're referring to, and then, the first session we're having now, I think one of the biggest takeaways, at least for myself personally, is just like the importance of these sorts of forums or events for convening and gathering people in food systems that may not always have a chance to connect or speak to one another. And there's lots of reasons for that. I mean, people are busy, but there's also, you know, a lot of fragmentations, you know, between, you know, farmers or policymakers or people that are eating food or even teachers that might be teaching or whatever, right? So often there isn't really a way for a lot of these different actors to connect. And so I think that's been really powerful just in terms of sharing ideas. With, you know, with the farmers and food producers last night, for example, you know, it became queer, you know, clear pretty quickly. There were some shared, you know, issues, concerns sort of in common, right? We had an extended kind of conversation about, you know, distribution and how do we scale up distribution of regional foods, right? And some common challenges experienced with respect to, you know, building a bigger pool of customers and, you know, distributing more widely, right? So I think there's a really big need for these sort of convening. And that's kind of really what the Food Policy Council was meant to do, right? Because too often, you know, food is really sort of, the food system's often really kind of fragmented in terms of policy, you know, like health has a piece over here and then maybe agriculture somewhere else. And often, you know, it's under economic development or whatever, there often isn't a more integrated forum for discussing some of these issues and bringing them together and connecting some of the pieces. And so this summer was really valuable for that because we had folks from across the food system to coming together. The focus group similarly, although we're focusing a little bit deeper now on kind of, you know, specific sort of aspects or questions and kind of groups in the food system. So I think that to me is one of the big takeaways and one of the big values. And, you know, the second would be, I think, related to that is hopefully, you know, this notion of sort of building food sovereignty, right? And in the kind of the larger food system, there's such a lack of control for farmers or fishers or eaters, right? Often in terms of, you know, where's the food coming from, who's growing it, who has control of inputs or seed supplies, you know, farmers being more, you know, price takers and these sorts of things, right? And being squeezed in different ways in value chains and just corporations and governments that are often, you know, complicit with what they want, really not responding to the need of, you know, communities, of localities, of regional, more ecological food production, I want to call it that. So I think, yeah, that need to convene and hopefully feel like, I think the local and the regional scales are really powerful in terms of building some of those connections, discussing shared issues and thinking about, you know, what can we do here? What are the assets and values we have here that allow us to build the food system in a more kind of food sovereign, you know, food system that the community, you know, kind of collectively wants.
As mentioned, the council has already gained insight into some of the key challenges and has begun brainstorming potential solutions based on feedback from participants in the first session.
We'll see the commonalities, I think, once we get more of the groups going. But in this first one, I think it was interesting to see some of the ideas that came out. Just people, you know, with this shared experience of in local food production. Some of the things that were talked about is like a food hub or a food cooperative. Is that something that would be helpful to our farmers? Also, some of the issues, like one of our biggest problems here is not enough food being produced locally. Farmers are kind of aging out of the system and they're not being replaced by young people coming into farming. So that's an issue there. And then other things like difficulties with local bylaws and the differences in enforcement and bylaws, even in between the counties, like Lennox and Addington and Frontenac counties, have different ways of dealing with growth in food production and farm businesses. And so those are the sorts of difficulties that the folks that came out to participate last night, those are the kinds of things that they were talking about.
Looking ahead, Mortfield and Lowitz say the next steps will be analyzing the information gathered and beginning to develop concrete action items once the sessions wrap up in early February.
Our hope is that we can kind of prioritize some of these ideas and actions on, you know, the quick wins, the ones that are going to take a few years of work. And we need to identify who needs to be involved to move these forward. And there's lots of work to be done, but setting some goals, you know, having a 2-year plan, a 5-year plan, a 10-year plan, and people at the table that are willing to tackle some of these, that's what we want to achieve out of these sessions.
Yeah, I mean, some of these, you know, the discussions, these focus groups have started to, you know, we've done kind of some of the larger sort of visioning exercises, and now we're really starting to focus on, you know, some of the concrete and tangible actions that communities, organizations, citizens in the food system can take and would like to see. So we've started to do some of that kind of actioning and prioritizing. And I think there's a lot of really, you know, concrete kind of proposals that came up even just in the session last night, right? Like, for example, is there potential to establish a food hub? We spent some time talking about, you know, a cooperative grocery store. There's another really tangible example. We had a representative from CASI, the Kingston Area Seed Saving Initiative, in attendance, who, you know, really was encouraging members of the community to grow out some of their local and traditional seeds, right? That's a really tangible action, right? That gardeners or school gardeners or farmers can take up, right? So I think we have some really kind of tangible examples, and there's, you know, it's fantastic for our council too, because I think this is the start of a process, right? It's sort of a food strategy, so then we can also identify, you know, some of these, you know, short, medium term, maybe longer term sort of policy actions or initiatives that we want to kind of collectively sort of work on or continue to convene, right, with these other groups in the food system and try to move ahead, right, coming out of this food strategy process.
Several consultations are still on the horizon. The Urban Food Production Consultation, focused on community gardeners, urban agriculture, and food forests, takes place Monday, January 19th from 5 to 8 p.m. The Food Security Consultation, centered on charitable and emergency food access, will follow on Monday, January 26th from 5 to 8 p.m. Food retail and distribution, including restaurants and local food outlets and markets, will be the focus on Monday, February 2nd from 5 to 8 p.m. The final consultation on food education and literacy involving school boards, public health, and educators takes place Monday, February 9th from 5 to 8 p.m. Community researcher Ayla Fenton is coordinating all 5 sessions. Those interested in participating in a consultation relevant to their work are encouraged to contact her at aylafoodpolicykfla@gmail.com. That's aylafoodpolicykfla@gmail.com. For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Laurie.
Thank you, Chris. Next is Dinah Jansen with a story from the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, Keith Dempsey, and it covers a possible traffic study of Garden Street in Gananoque.
Thank you, Jesse. Gananoque Town Council is set to review a report on proposed traffic calming measures for Garden Street at its Wednesday meeting, with staff recommending a traffic impact study before any changes are made. The study would examine options to reduce speed limits and improve safety on the residential street, particularly between Herbert Street and Talbot Place. The initiative stems from a request late last August by resident Richard Ferguson, who suggested speed bumps, a lower speed limit, and additional stops to improve safety. Council initially directed staff to investigate the proposal in August 2025, but the report was postponed in December due to time constraints and is now being presented for consideration. The affected block of Garden Street is approximately 205 meters long, with an 18-meter right-of-way, and sees an average of 131 vehicles per day, according to 2022 traffic data. In comparison, other sections of Garden Street and nearby Talbot Place experience higher traffic volumes, with daily counts ranging from 194 to 445 vehicles. Staff has explored several potential solutions, including installing speed bumps or stop signs, converting the intersection at Talbot Place into a dead end, or returning Garden Street to two-way traffic from Herbert Street to Wilson Drive. While each option is feasible, staff stresses that implementing changes without a full understanding of their impact could create unintended traffic issues in the area. To address this, staff is recommending that the town contract a qualified consultant to conduct a traffic impact study. The study, estimated to cost approximately $10,000, would provide recommendations based on best practices for street design and traffic management. It could also include an assessment of nearby streets, including King Street East and Wilson Drive, which are slated for realignment as part of future development south of Elmwood Drive. Thank you to Keith Dempsey for that story. Now over to Jesse Bell with a sports story about a Queensgale football player who is receiving draft interest from both the CFL and NFL.
Thank you, Dinah. After an outstanding season serving as the blindside blocker for the Queen's Gaels, all-Canadian tackle Nicholas Hennig was invited to the 2026 College Gridiron Showcase. Held in Fort Worth, Texas, the Gridiron Showcase is an annual event designed to shine a spotlight on some of the hidden gem prospects for both the CFL and NFL draft. Last year, Canadian quarterback Taylor Elgersma's performance was so strong that it resulted in him receiving an invitation to the Senior Bowl, an event usually reserved for only the best and brightest American college football players. Nick Hennig was one of 16 Canadian players selected for the Gridiron Showcase, and the early buzz coming out of Fort Worth is that he had the strongest performance of the bunch. Hennig, a former H-back turned tackle, boasts some impressive physical intangibles. Standing 6'5" and weighing in at a shade under 300 pounds, Hennig possesses an unusual level of athleticism and agility for a man of his size, thanks to his days of playing H-back. Though scouts noted that there were still some technical inconsistencies to his game, his imposing frame and explosive athleticism make him a prospect with a lot of potential moving forward. Canadian football scout J.C. Abbott, who was there in Texas to cover the Canadian contingent, stated that he feels that Hennig is the, quote, odds-on favorite to be the first U-Sports player selected in the upcoming CFL draft. He added that, should Hennig perform well at the March Combine, an NFL minicamp invite may be in his future as well. Nicholas Hennig still has one more season of U-Sports football eligibility with the Gaels, but he may choose to move on and pursue what could be a very promising professional football career.
Thank you, Jesse. Now over to the LJI reporter for CJAI-FM, Amherst Island Radio, Ted Evans, with a story about the impact the BCG STEM grant has had in Loyalist Township.
BGC Southeast's first round of STEM field trips were a success, according to the organization. Between September and December 2025, over 500 students from schools in Loyalist Township visited BGC's STEM and Robotics Center. Students from grades 5 through 12 were able to take part in free field trips funded by a community grant from Loyalist Township. Associate Director of STEM and Strategic Initiatives at BGC Southeast, Bruna Guarino-Moraes, explained how the Loyalist Township Community Grant helped them organize the field trips.
We got a Loyalist Township, the community grant, which is how we were able to do this project. We had never done it before, but I would say that normally we don't get 500 kids in field trips, but yeah, it was very successful. I think having the Loyalist Community Grant be able to fund this, we were able to offer everything for free to all the schools. So we had the BGC bus, so we had transportation, we had all the staffing, materials. So we arranged everything for the school. So everyone that we reached out to was really willing to and excited to come. We really wanted to reach everyone. So that was really nice that we were able to get a class from Amherst Island. So they took the ferry and our bus met them at the ferry and brought them to BGC and then dropped them off at the ferry again. We were able to reach all the schools in Loyalist Township, which was really, really nice to see.
Guarino-Moraes talks about what the students experience on the field trips.
It obviously varies a little bit depending on their age range, but really we were doing like hands-on workshops in robotics, coding, and 3D design and fabrication. So they varied a little bit, but most of them, they were using, they're these like Lego Spike Prime robotics kits. So they get to build robots, and then they also get to do like coding to program the robots. And then they also got to do a CAD design session where they were designing their own keychains, for example. And then we were printing them off in our 3D printer and they got to go home with it as well, which was nice. And then just getting a tour as well of the STEM Center, because a lot of the kids had never been here before. And even though, of course, it's a little bit far for Loyalist residents, it's still really nice that they know that they have this resource available.
Guarino-Moraes went on to note the interest from students and teachers.
Afterwards, we had some teachers reaching out wanting to book more field trips, or, you know, then they learned that we have our after-school evening STEM and robotics programs. And so a lot of the kids wanted to know more about that, and some of them even signed up. So it was just really nice for them to learn about this resource in the community. Teachers were sending us like emails after the sessions, like completely unprompted, like, oh, the the kids were like singing on the bus back to school and things like that. So that was just really, really heartfelt when, you know, we're not asking for testimonials. They're just kind of thanking us and giving us some praise. So it just, you know, it helps us keep going.
Guarino Moraes talks about the importance of funding going forward.
The constraint is really just the funding. We would love to do it for free, but finding that sustainable source of funding is important. I think with the Loyalist Township grant, we definitely are looking forward to applying for it again, at least next year. But in the time being, like, we saw how successful this was and how much the kids enjoyed it and learned from it. So we're looking at other opportunities. I mean, we obviously can't offer we do like field trips for a small cost where parents can pay a little bit for their kids to come, but it obviously becomes a bit of an obstacle, but that is always an option until we find more grants to support this.
For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Over to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFWN Coburg, Dan Jones, with a story about local reactions to the removal of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro from power.
Hi, I'm Dan Jones with CFWN in Coburg, Ontario. Despite Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro being arrested and displaced from his position, a Trent Hills man who was born in the South American country says life will become much harder for his fellow countrymen before it gets better. Emilio Ojeda says taking out Maduro but not replacing the current administration will do little to change the situation.
I was born and raised in Venezuela, and I moved to Canada in 2007 after living a few years in the United States, in New York.
Obviously, the news of the President Maduro being arrested in early January shocked the world. What's your take on that situation?
To be honest, I believe that this is just, you know, a circus just mounted by President Trump to get away with stale files. And that is because took Maduro and Maduro's wife, but he didn't change anybody else. So yeah, he took one of the actors, but he left the rest of the actors there. In other words, nothing has changed at all. People are still having trouble. People are still disappearing. People are still having, have to be in line for hours to get a piece of meat or, you know, any of the basic staples to survive. People still have to pay everything with American dollars, and people there don't earn in American dollars. They still earn in Bolivar. So the situation is exactly the same, hasn't changed anything. You know, it's not even about the oil. I have some confrontations with friends and family and people from Venezuela that they don't care about the oil as long as they are free. It's a high price to pay because, again, Venezuela has one of the biggest reserve of oil in the world. However, that oil is very heavy, and it costs a lot of money to refine. You have to build special refineries. Unfortunately, the regime in Venezuela didn't invest in modernizations of the plants there, and they are all growing. They are not working. So it's a shame because Venezuela used to live from that. I would like to take this opportunity to make sure people understand that saying that Venezuelan regime is a socialist or right or any spectrum of the political ambience is not true. They are just bad actors in a facade of socialism, just stealing and the money produced by the Venezuelan oil that they can, and taking and using the government asset to deliver drugs around the world. For instance, those little ships that were bombarded, that they were not. They are fishermen. They might have some drugs in there, but it's impossible for those little boats to go from Venezuela to the U.S. is there's no way. You need to ton of gas and hours. So so that was part of the trip. That was part of the smog gone to Trump administration to delivery with the attention from something bad and something worse.
Now, Emilio, in your discussions with family and friends in Venezuela, what are they telling you about the situation there on the ground?
They are tired, obviously. This situation has been in Venezuela for more than 20 years, and they were really excited that something was changing, although they came to realize already that it's not the case. Nothing has changed, and probably nothing will change. Again, the coming back to the oil, the American oil companies are not taking the Venezuelan oil because they don't want to invest an exceptional amount of money that they can they won't recover in years and years. So the situation there is, as you can see, it's just a smoking gun for other stuff.
The international news coming out about Venezuela is that the vice president has been appointed, basically the interim head of state, and that the government still recognizes Nicolas Maduro as the president and that they are demanding his release. Do you see the current political structure worsening conditions for people? Like, do you think that there'll be a heavier crackdown given what happened with the United States coming in and arresting Maduro?
Of course. It's good to say that Delcy Rodriguez is part of the regime. She was the number two. And that's what I said. Nothing has changed. She's the new interim president. I'm going to call it that way. But to be honest, Maduro wasn't elected neither. He took it by force. He changed the number. You know, I have information from even the center, the data center from the Electoral College in Caracas, that by 5 a.m, the opposition candidate was 3-1. So suddenly in the early hours that the whole thing changed in a national level. He's not, and most of the countries in the world hasn't accepted him as the legit president of Venezuela. And the rest of the people is not legitimate. The problem here is that for these to be effective, everybody have to be changed. Everybody from the president to the police officers has to be changed. We have an infiltration of Cuban military and our own military. I haven't heard any country that allowed another country force take care of their own. So you can see the level of corruption right there. The cartel of the soul, the Sole, mean the soul, the Sun cartels, is they're calling like that because the high officers in the military have, instead of stars, they have some souls. From Sole, from Soons, and they are the corrupt ones. They are the ones that are traveling using Venezuelan assets like ships and planes to bring the drug to anywhere in the world.
There's some hope that this incident may spark a call for democracy and more free elections. Are you hopeful for that? And are you seeing that in what you're hearing and experiencing back home?
No, I'm not. Honestly, I'm not hoping. I know that it won't be happening anytime soon. Here's what an anomaly said, that the enemy of your enemy is not necessarily your friend. And you see that Trump's government have been very corrupt and very authoritarian. And do you think that government like that wouldn't necessarily help Trump in another country? So this whole parody of intervention in another country definitely is going to be seen in other countries, thinking that, like Iran right now, they think that the United States can come and take somebody out and everything going to be fine, and it's not the case. Things normally go for war. And history is, you know, a witness. Every time the U.S. trying to change the conditions in a country, everything goes for war. It happened in Chile, happened in Panama, it happened in other places.
Reporting for CFWN and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Dan Jones.
And thank you to Dan Jones for that story. Next up on The Corridor, supported by local realtor Kim Purcell at kimpurcell.ca, is Jesse Bell with CFRC's Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Thursday, January 22nd, daytime high of -6 with a mix of sun and cloud, feeling closer to -11 with the wind chill. Friday, January 23rd, a little bit colder, daytime high of -9. But we will see less wind chill, so in the sun at the peak of the day, it'll actually feel a little closer to -4, even if the temperature is technically forecasted to be lower than Thursday. Saturday, January 24th, -8 is your high. Snowy, cold, feeling like -17. Sunday, January 25th, -14, with a wind chill feeling closer to -20. A little bit of sun, mostly clouds in the forecast. And then moving into the start of next week, Monday, January 26th, high of -11, feeling like -20, with a 60% chance of snow in the forecast as well.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. We'll be right back.